Thank you, everybody, for joining this Africa Unconstrained webinar. It is the seventh and the last in our series, and we have a really fantastic discussion lined up for you. I hope you're all really excited to join. I certainly am. My name is Hannah Ryder. I'm the CEO of Development Reimagined, which is an international development consultancy headquartered in China. We also have offices in Kenya and the UK, and we're really pleased to be here with you today to share this important discussion and bring to you some brilliant panelists to discuss issues related to Africa's development and in particular financial development. Before I introduce the our fantastic lineup of speakers today, panelists, I would just like to do a little bit of housekeeping. First of all, there is some interpretation available for those of you who speak Chinese or French more fluently than I do. You can follow that. There's a button just there for you to listen to the Chinese or the French translation if you would like. And we will also have a Q&A session. The Q&A is open, so please, those of you who are attending, please, in the audience, please do share your questions. Share them as soon as you can, as they come to you, as you're listening to the panelists. We look forward to that session and discussing what your observations and your concerns are as part of this discussion. And we will also have a couple of polls as well for the audience. So I think hopefully that will be something of interest. We always do that in these webinars so that we actually understand who we're talking to, who we're talking with. So I hope you'll engage in that too. So without much further ado, let me introduce the topic of our discussion today of this seventh last webinar in the series, Africa Unconstrained series. The topic today is going to be on special drawing rights in particular. And the question is, the overall context is the world's largest lenders of last resort. The world's largest lender of last resort, as you know, is the IMF. And the question is, what is the IMF? What can the IMF do, in particular through special drawing rights, to help address the COVID-19 recovery and other grey rhinos? Grey rhinos is a term which was introduced by Michelle Wicker into this world had been really helpful in terms of helping us think through these issues, which are certainly predictable. That's what she says, they're predictable, but they are slowly predictable. And so whether countries, whether governments, whether organizations actually deal with them is obviously a massive choice. And so issues such as COVID-19 and climate change fall into that category. We're going to be focusing on whether special drawing rights issued by the IMF can be reallocated to ensure African countries can finance these kinds of grey rhinos. And if we do come up with some recommendations, hopefully we will, I'll be asking our panelists to do that. If we do, that would be wonderful. We may also touch on wider issues to do with Africa's financing, touching on some of the other issues that we've talked about in this webinar, but our key point will be around special drawing rights. So who's gonna help us do this? Well, I have three fantastic guests here with me. I'll introduce them to you in turn. First of all, I've got Jude Moore, who's a Senior Policy Fellow at the Center for Global Development. He's former Minister of Public Works, former Minister of Infrastructure in Liberia. He was in that role from 2014 to 2018, and he also served as Deputy Chief of Staff to President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and was also head of the President's Delivery Unit at the time as well, and looked over public sector investment programs. So very, very, very relevant experience Jude has, and he's also put proposals and out on issues around the SDRs and on Africa's financing in general. So we're really pleased to have him here with us today. He also did play a crucial role in supporting President Sirleaf's and Liberia in responding to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa and shaping that post-Ebola outlook. So we're really pleased to have you here with us. Thank you, Jude, for joining us. I also have Jason Braganza, who's the Executive Director at AfroDad, which stands for the African Forum and Network on Debt and Development. He's a Kenyan economist, over 10 years experience working on international development in Africa. And he has been working over the last decade on trade, regional integration, finance for development, and tax, illicit financial flows, domestic resource mobilization, and also poverty and inequality, of course. Before becoming ED at AfroDad, he was the co-head and program director of tax at the International Lawyers Project, leading legal pro bono tax reform. And he was also the deputy executive director and head of research for the Tax Justice Network Africa. And he also worked at Development Initiatives, which is where we first met while he was doing that in the Africa Hub. And he was also an economist at the Ministry of East Africa Community in Kenya. So really pleased to have you with us, Jason. I know AfroDad have been very following this issue, been shaping policy on this issue, writing letters and so on to IMF and global organizations and leaders on Africa's financial needs and debt issues. So we're really pleased to have you here to share the organization's perspective, your perspective on these questions. Thanks, Jason. And last but not least, and I'm not quite sure if she has yet managed to join us, we will have, we do have one more guest. She hasn't joined us yet, has she? Oh dear, she may be having some problems. We were having some issues, some Zoom issues earlier. Our other guest is Anne Pettifor. I will introduce her when she joins. It might be easier to do that. But for now, let's kick off with Jude and Jason in that case for the moment, and hopefully Anne will join us shortly. So let me begin with my first question. I'm going to kind of try and stimulate the debate here at the for now, and then we'll also, as I mentioned, we'll have a Q&A later. Actually, before I do, let me just ask, let's see if the audience, could we ask a question to the audience? Let's put the poll to the audience and see if that will...
Anne just arrived, right?
Oh, hello, Anne. Great to see you. Thank you for joining us. I'll introduce you in a moment in that case, but why don't we put the poll to the audience, and then I'll introduce Anne Pettifor. So the audience question is, do you think special drawing rights could help with development and financing of African countries? And you've got three options there, dear audience. The first answer would be yes. Special drawing rights are essential for African countries' development and financing. Two, I'm not sure how SDRs, special drawing rights, could help. No, it would be the third answer. SDRs would be just wasted if they go to African governments. So panelists can't vote because I'm going to ask them what they think. But let's see what the audience say for now. Let's give you a few moments to respond. Should we let the audience respond? Let's just have a few moments. Is the audience voting? Let's just check with the DR team. Check with the audience are voting. We can't see the results at the moment. Quite often we can. Have we got the votes in yet? Aha, we have. All right. So we have the answer from our audience. We have 67% of the audience say yes, they're essential for African countries' development and financing. We've got 22% of the audience saying they're not sure how special drawing rights could help. And 11% say they'll just be wasted if they go to African governments. So, right, let's have our panelists answer this question. But before we do, let me just introduce Anne Pettifor, who has just joined us. Thank you so much. Yeah. I'm glad the Zoom link worked this time. Anne Pettifor, really wonderful to have you with us. She's a fellow of the New Economics Foundation and the director of Prime Economics. She's a political economist, she's an author and public speaker. And in 2006, she warned of the great financial crisis in her book, which was called The Coming First World Debt Crisis. And she authored another book in 2008 called The Green New Deal. And she's also authored The Production of Money, which is all about the nature of money, debt and the finance sector. She's been awarded several prizes, including the Hannah Arendt Prize in 2018. She's been leading a number of discussions on debt cancellation and led those discussions for the Jubilee 2000 movement, made a huge impact on that. So we're really pleased to have Anne with us today again.
Thank you so much, and I'm delighted to be here. Just apologize for being late.
No worries, thank you so much. All right, so I was going to kick off a first question to Jude Moore. Jude, what's your view on special drawing rights, whether they're needed, the case for reallocating special drawing rights to African and other poorer countries to deal with something like COVID-19, and or climate change, these sorts of grey rhinos. Is that enough? Are they needed? What about other financing gaps? What's your view on this, Jude?
Thanks again for having me, Anna, and really glad to be here this morning. This saying became famous when Rahm Emanuel was chief of staff to President Obama, that you don't let a good crisis go to waste. And so I think for those of us who've been thinking that the international system, the architecture of global international finance, especially development finance, has been inadequate in terms of addressing the needs of countries, the poorest countries in the world. And a crisis like this one becomes an opportunity for us to advance our idea of restructuring or refitting the global international finance architecture so that it will be able to. So for example, on the SDRs, we know that first, just based on the quotas, the lion's share of the new SDRs are gonna go to the countries who in this position are least in need of it. So in Africa, for example, the top seven economies will account for 50% of the SDRs. So the recommendations go from, just acknowledge the reality of the way things are and that anything is better than nothing. So that even if the top seven economies in Africa.
Donc si les sept pays, les sept plus grandes économies,
这些国家呢，他们也是在使用这个
the views. There is a view that says, there should be some sort of onward lending and reallocation after that. But it can't be just for free. This is an opportunity, just the same way that people who've called for reform in terms of quota allocation for SDRs, there are people on the other side who believe that there are public financial management reforms that need to happen in African governments. And this is an opportunity for you to do that. So you don't just extend and extra SDRs to African governments without attaching strings in terms of changes that should come in the public financial management. And then of course, so there's a whole range of, of, of opinions in terms of what should happen. I would note, though, that at the last meeting at the UNECA, the African finance ministers did issue a statement that said that they had already breached their fiscal limits. There's not much more that they can do. They're direly in need of this. We know that within the first quarter of the pandemic, over $100 billion left emerging markets for the safety of more developed markets, that by and large, you know, the cost of borrowing for developed economies is significantly lower than the cost of borrowing for African countries, many of whom, when they issue international debt, have to do so in foreign currency as euro bonds. And so that also carries risk, it carries its own risk for their economies. The final thing I would say is that the countries that have been most affected by this pandemic are those who are largely dependent on tourism and on commodity exports. And you're describing an African economy when you say that. So it means with demand destruction, with the decline in global demand for the commodities we export, these countries are at least capable of domestically raising the resources they need. So I think I'll go back to the recommendation you and I made, Anna, in our piece. I know that my colleagues who worked at the IMF and who understand how it worked, the thing is the craziest thing anyone could do because nobody's gonna listen to that. But our recommendation is that, you know, a reallocation that means up to 125 billion, if we were to get 650 billion, would be available to the poorest countries, not just to Africa, but to the poorest countries in the world. Because this affords us an opportunity to address big development questions that previously we hadn't. So I think on this, because I'm on the public record of having made that recommendation, I'm going to stick with that today. And thank you again. And this, I'll end my first comments there.
Thanks, Jude. And you know, like our audience, you're allowed to change your mind as well. But if your mind is just strengthened by these discussions, that's also fine. I mean, you know, there have been plenty of responses to the proposal that we made around SDRs, as you said. But there have also been other proposals from others. So I, you know, this is an opportunity to discuss those and to think about, you know, what really works and what won't work. Jason, what has AfroDad been saying with regards to SDRs? I know there has been this $650 billion decision that has been taken. Does AfroDad think that these should be reallocated? Are they sufficient? What needs to be done?
Great. Thank you so much, Hannah, and to Jude and Anne. This is a very great moment to be having this conversation, actually, given that the IMF's World Bank spring meetings have just concluded, and we're sort of deep into the financing for development UN meetings this week. And I think there's no apt time to have this discussion. I think I'll just start off by saying, you know, AfroDad's position and that of many of our civil society partners across the continent on special drawing rights is that it's not the silver bullet that everybody thinks it is for the African continent. And it should not be seen in isolation vis-a-vis the other debt relief measures or debt instruments that are being put forward to provide immediate liquidity and immediate fiscal space for developing countries at this moment in time, and specifically on the continent. The original figures that were being estimated towards, you know, the autumn or winter last year by UNCTAD, for example, were to the tune of about $2.5 trillion US dollars, right? And this had accounted for the entire financing package that would be needed, of which I think $1 trillion was going to be from SDRs. Nonetheless, we've gone from trillions to billions, and you know, the way things are looking, we might even be moving from billions to millions. And so things aren't looking so good in that regard. And if, you know, if we were to take the current figure that's being discussed at the fund of $650 billion. And you sort of use the current allocation models, the amount that's coming to the continent, sub-Saharan Africa, is about $22 billion of that 650. So you can actually see it's quite a tiny amount, which means then if you know further break that down into individual countries, the amount of resource that's available from this SDR allocation is going to be very little relative to other finance that's available. Now, the question is, how do SDR, or how should SDRs work with other initiatives that are currently in place? And for AfroDAT, this is something that we have been stating categorically, that we see them working with an extended or an extension of, for example, the debt suspension service initiative, a greater inclusion of all creditors and IFIs through the G20's common framework. And, you know, we feel that only through this sort of approach and holistic approach can the SDRs then actually tend towards having a more impactful status or a more impactful role in supporting and buffering African economies as they try to climb out of this current crisis. But it doesn't take away some of the points that Jude has made, right, on things around economic governance, the structural transformation agenda on the continent that's likely to take a hit, and I'm sure we'll touch on this. But essentially, we should really be looking at the SDRs as one of many options in terms of trying to provide immediate liquidity right now. But there needs to be also some medium to long-term considerations on what that actually means in preventing or sustainably building the continent out of this current crisis.
Thanks, Jason. And that's really clear. And I'm glad you also mentioned that, yes, we have, there are a number of financing discussions happening right now, and this is absolutely the right time to be discussing these points and to be forming views on them in order to shape the future. And you have looked at SDRs, you looked at the role of SDRs in the debt crisis, the previous debt crisis, and in the financial crisis. SDRs were not used in the African debt crisis of the 1980s and 1990s. So what's different now? Why would we be looking at SDRs now? And is there a case for reallocation in your view, or use in a different kind of way? Anne, please go ahead. I think you're still muted.
Mute myself, right? Is that it?
Yes, we can hear you now.
And I can't see you now for some reason. Let me just, where are you? Never mind. First of all, thank you so much for having me. And thank you also for including me on this excellent panel. I worked with AfroDAT for the Jubilee 2000 campaign and subsequently, and so it's good to be back home in a way, right? As you also know, I'm South African born. My family still live there, most of my family. And so I feel very strongly about this issue. Number one, countries now urgently need dollar bills in order to be able to buy pharmaceuticals and in order to buy the vaccine. And that in itself is a grave injustice that you know, in the case of the AstraZeneca vaccine, the British public, the British taxpayer, has paid for this. Something like 95% of the investment in that vaccine was paid for by the ordinary people of Britain. And the fact that we now are, it's owned by a private company, and the private company is making decisions as to where it will sell and for what price and how much it'll give to African governments, is a failure, if you like, of international, a profound failure of international solidarity. So it's no surprise to me that in those circumstances, African governments, including the South African government, urgently need to be able to access dollar bills in order to pay for this stuff. So I understand that, and I don't want to, from my high horse and from my theoretical ivory tower, to be lecturing African governments on that. I'm personally again SDRs, mainly because of the conditionality, but also because it's just another way of getting US dollars. And the US has been very selective in the way it has decided to share US dollars with its partners in the world. OECD governments got access to dollars when they ran, OECD government central banks, should I say, had access to dollars when there was a shortage post-crisis, when money flooded back to the United States. But there were many countries that were excluded from that largesse, including South Africa, but also Venezuela, of course, and Iran and China. So the United States is extraordinarily selective about who will use this reserve currency over which they have such immense imperial power, in my view. But I wanted to come on to a second point, which is I heard speak of the fiscal limits that African governments have faced. Now, there ain't no fiscal limits. There is an awful lot of fiscal rules about this, an awful lot talked about fiscal limits. But the fiscal limits we face are the limits of the capacity of our economy, essentially. And the idea that, for example, South Africa, which has massive unemployment, which has obscene levels of unemployment, has reached fiscal limits is really untrue. I mean, untrue is the kindest word I can say about it, really. And I think that, for me, is the problem. Now, the problem is that governments who want to expand the fiscal envelope, if you like, who want to create domestic currency, to generate more domestic currency, to invest in the domestic economy, create jobs, generate income from those jobs, including tax income, to balance the public books, if you like, that won't help pay for some pharmaceuticals from abroad. But I want us to understand that actually one of the weaknesses of our economies in Africa is that governors of central banks and treasury ministers, finance ministers, buy into this idea that actually there are fiscal limits, that there are rules about how much fiscal space there is, and so on. And I think that those are very deeply flawed. We've learned here in Britain, we were taught here in Britain, that actually we face fiscal limits. From 2010 onwards, George Osborne told us that we'd, you know, broken the bank. Professor Reinhardt and Rogoff assured governments, including the United States government, the British government, that when fiscal spending reached 90% of GDP, the end of world was nigh.
Inflation,
et cetera, et cetera. And so this gave right-wing orthodox economists and politicians all the munition they needed to, if you like, downsize the state. And they went about and did that. In this crisis, the opposite has happened. A Tory government has decided to spend, spend, spend. It turns out that we had far more fiscal space than anyone ever imagined, or any economist, any orthodox economist, or indeed any economist imagined. And to be fair, our Tory chancellor began to do exactly that, understood that you could either let the economy implode and everybody would suffer, including big corporations, or you could sustain it through this crisis. And they decided to sustain it, and it turned out that there is a magic money tree. You know, the slogans in past elections was that there is no magic money tree. There is always a magic money tree for bailing out the finance sector, for bailing out banks, Wall Street, London, et cetera. But there was never a magic money tree for bailing out the people and the economy. But now that argument has been defeated. It's not possible to argue now here in Britain about fiscal limits. But I see in Africa that there are still these conversations going on. So, you know, while I accept that temporarily, and I'm very unhappy about it because of IMF conditionality, and IMF conditionality is about reorienting every African government so that it's aimed at exports. And the reason that export-led economies are so important to the global system is that exports generate dollar bills, essentially, US dollars. And those can be bought to pay for computers or whatever it is that are not being made at home. So all economies have been oriented towards doing that. And that is really very helpful, if you like, for the international financial system, which benefits because they are not prepared to accept repayment of debts or anything in South African rands. They have to have US dollars. But we shouldn't be going along with that orientation of our economies. We should be attending to the people of Africa. We should be building their capacity. We should be building up their health systems to make sure that Africans are as healthy and as what's the word I want, you know, have all of this, the education and the skills that they need in order to participate fully in the economy. So long as we accept that actually governments don't do that, shouldn't do that, but instead should focus on exporting commodities, so long will we have injustices of the scale that we have at the moment, but so long will the US dollar be powerful and will the international financial system have, and institutions like the IMF have, such power over African governments. So I'm sorry for that long intervention, but I feel very strongly about this.
No, it's great. And I think this is the point. We need to discuss these options. We've actually had a discussion. One of the webinars was focused on that, those questions around fiscal space and what is the evidence actually behind, for instance, the 60% debt to GDP ratio, which is often used to say, well, okay, now countries need to stop spending. And as part of that discussion, we also talked about the fact that many of the, where there is scrutiny and surveillance through IMF, for instance, through the programs, debt sustainability programs, the assets of countries, African countries included, are not taken into account. It's literally just an examination of liabilities, which is very restricted. And also, of course, the evidence itself is 60%. So there's real issues around those issues. So would you, around those calculations. So would you say, and I'd like Jude and Jason to come in here as well, would you say then the answer is not SDRs and it's expanding fiscal space, or would you say it's something else? How do we provide those, how do we provide extra finance to deal with grey rhinos? How do African countries build up that finance and immediately as well?
So I would just, you know, I very strong opinions there, and on the question of this, my favorite professor in undergrad was a Lebanese American, and he, you know, he said that international affairs followed the golden rule, and every kid growing up who's heard of the golden rule understands the golden rule to be, you know, you do unto others as you expect them to do unto you. He's like, no, not that golden rule, the other golden rule. And the other golden rule is he who has the gold makes the rules, right? And so for most African countries, I mean, this is the environment in which we have to work. This is the environment in which we have to, and I'm here, as I noted, I mean, in to Anne's point, the Trump administration, just before they left office, did a $900 billion stimulus package. So the Biden administration comes on and does, you know, is it $1.2 trillion? And now considering a $2.3 trillion. Some mainstream economists like Larry Summers, you know, have been arguing that the economy might overheat, you know, and there will be, and it appears like the Biden administration is ignoring them. The Biden administration is ignoring, the economists who, I would say, held great sway between 2008 and now. But I don't know if that kind of space is available for African actors, right? Because we're talking about African actors who, even before the pandemic, the UNHCR reports that up to 25 economies on the continent were spending more on debt servicing than the combined spending on health, on education, and something else, and social services. We're talking about countries, many of whom depend on some form of budget support, whether it's from the EU or from other donors, for them to be able to run their economies. And so the autonomy to act, the freedom and independence to act at exactly the moment where you are turning to, you know, the makers of, the owners of the gold, for support of your economy, it makes it, it's very, very constrained environment for African countries to perform and act as autonomous actors. What I would say, though, in thinking about this is, it's hard for us to talk about the international system and where Africans stand in an international system if we don't talk about why, right? There is a pattern of trade that goes back to colonial times that sees Africa as almost exclusively as a source of unprocessed goods, but as a market for finished goods. And just basic understanding of economics know that the lower you are on the value chain, the less value you actually extract from the process. So for example, in South Africa today, South African farmers, peer farmers, are frustrated because it's taking more than 14 months to get any clearance for them to be able to ship to China. What Africa produces in large quantities are agricultural products, but exporting those agricultural products to Western markets face huge non-tariff barriers. And so all of the areas in which Africa could actually be able to increase its share of global trade in terms of its exports, those are the things that have either the least value or that face the highest barriers in able to do that. So consequently, if we wanted to spend, you know, $1 trillion on our combined economy, I know since this outbreak, Ken Oforiatta of Ghana, Abiy Ahmed of Ethiopia, have been calling for about $300 billion for African economies. That's not going to happen. And so unless African governments are in the position where they can actually be able to make such a decision, I think we're going to have to. And then the final thing, and then I will stop, is it is not crazy and out of the ordinary for us to also have a conversation about the quality of public financial management on the continent, right? There is this thing happening in Kenya now where Kenyans are basically petitioning the IMF and saying, don't lend our government any more money. Because if you lend them money, we're not going to get it. There is even a clip of this guy who runs, you know, Boda Bodas, and he's on the phone supposedly with the IMF and telling them, if you want to support businesses, here's my M-Pesa number, send the money directly to me, do not send the money to my government. I know he's been funny, but there is a need for African governments to be responsible to their people in terms of the quality of their spending, the quality of the choice of projects that we're spending on, and how that money is being used, especially in for the people on whose behalf they're getting these loans. So I think that's where I want to end for now.
Thanks, Judo. And what about you, Jason? I mean, that point about our African governments spending well, this is obviously a concern when it comes to SDRs or any other expanded form of finance, even private sector finance. For AfroDad, and from your perspective, what is the answer? How can there be? Because there are clear financing needs, right? There are.
Yeah.
There's a huge infrastructure financing gap. You know, we're talking about COVID-19, we're talking about climate change, an additional 20, 30 billion a year just in Africa. How is that done with more finance, more accounts? What is the answer, Jason?
I wish I did have the answer, because then, you know, I'd be probably sitting in Washington during these meetings, presenting these answers. But I want to start off where both Jude and Anne have left off, which is, I think the first and foremost thing to understand or to appreciate in this current crisis is that the continent was, broadly speaking, already headed towards this debt precipice. COVID-19, what COVID-19 has done has accelerated the debt crisis on the continent. And I think also what the pandemic has done has also exposed some of the harsh realities in the weaknesses in some of the development models that are being provided in the form of technical assistance or technical advice to some of our governments. And Jude put it very well, if I can paraphrase, is that there has been an erosion of the self-determination of many African states. And so the conditionalities that and the powers that organizations like the IMF and other IFIs hold on national treasuries and central banks remains extremely strong. And I think this is then the opportunity really for governments on the continent to relook at an alternative model of development, an alternative way of financing. Because the third thing that the COVID-19 pandemic has brought to the fore, and even though it's, you know, less spoken about, is the continent's role or position within the global supply chain or the global trading system. You know, at the peak, the first peak of the pandemic in the summer of last year, it was very evident, you know, how supply chains were disrupted because, you know, raw materials from the continent were not making it to, you know, factories and other destinations to be converted into finished goods. So the role of the continent in global supply chain and global trade and commerce has really, you know, has been has been seen to be quite an integral part in that process. And so when we're talking about the effectiveness of the special drawing rights, and I have to agree with Anne here around the conditionalities that are likely to come on, not just with special drawing rights, but the accompanying other loans, because special drawing rights generally tend not to necessarily have any conditions attached to them, but it's the other loans that are being handed out by the IMF that we've got to worry about. Jude has mentioned Kenya here, and for example, the most recent loan that's been approved, $2.3 billion, some of it does have conditions related to taxes. So for example, hikes in fuel tax here in Kenya. And this is likely to have an impact on Kenya's ability to recover because the fuel you know, is a major source of energy. If you want industry to recover, this is going to be quite difficult. So the question is, how do we, as different actors, first of all, number one, get the agenda on self-determination of the continent, you know, to be at the forefront of any sort of recovery at the political level in terms of alternative. Second is to actually understand how different financing instruments can be transformative. And I think this is the point where we're not seeing the debt that has been accumulated over the past 15 years on the continent has had very limited transformative impact in terms of jobs, in terms of mechanizing or industrializing any of the countries. We're still very much dependent on primary commodities. We're still very much dependent on industries like tourism. There's been very little that has been done to move the continent with the debt finance available up the value chain and up the supply chain in many of the productive sectors. And we've also then disinvested in social sectors, which are very fundamental now that we're talking about you know, recovery and how SDRs would be used. A lot of the arguments in support of SDRs is that they should be invested in social sectors, in health specifically, to, you know, on the one hand to procure vaccines, but also to invest in social protection programs, in buffering these up, in trying to get the continent out of the current crisis. So I do think that there is an important point here in terms of looking forward. And the use of additional fiscal space and liquidity that's being created, that there is a transformative agenda that comes out of this. And it's not more of the same where we continue to you know, put flowers in aeroplanes and send them to Europe or export copper ore to China where they can be converted into cobalt that can be used in the manufacturing of laptops. These things should be done on the continent. And I think when that sort of investment or that sort of debt is then invested in transformative impacts and transformations of our economies, then we can genuinely start talking about being able to do quantitative easing and there not being any debt ceilings and for us to have debt to GDP ratios that are over 100%. I think, you know, it's for those reasons that you know, many economists will argue that African countries can't do that because we just don't have the tax to GDP ratios to do this, which I think is not necessarily correct because the architecture as designed, as Jude has mentioned, is deliberately made to make the continent stay behind and not move up this chain and be able to then access and develop in this transformative way.
Yeah, these are so complex. And it's just, in a sense, we have to work on all of them simultaneously, I guess, which is the first step. You know, what first step do we take? our team did a report which preceded these webinars, which was looking at 10 different options for reimagining Africa's debt system. And we looked at, you know, structural transformation itself, looking at these debt ceilings as we've just been discussing. Other options, the structural adjustment type programs. What can we do? What can we do now? What can we do today with SDRs and available finance? I'm also going to just mention, by the way, that we've actually got one Q&A that's already come in, and I think there's a few others that are going to be coming in and encouraging our audience to share more. Perhaps we should go also to our Q&A immediately, and we have one specifically for you, which was first saying brilliantly provocative, thank you. But the audience member Charlie Robertson wanted to ask about the point around dollars in the international system, and I guess it also comes back to this sort of structural challenges situation that African countries find themselves in. When I think you mentioned that China, India, Europe, and the US sell to Africa, they're looking to be paid in dollars as well for the products they make, and African governments spending more without earning dollars. Could you just explain your point around the need for investment and imports and the foreign currency? But also, please also do respond to the other points that Jude and Jason have made as well. I think you're on mute again, Anne.
Gosh, you'd think I'd worked this out by now. So Charlie is asking about whether or not, if Western governments are Western governments and big corporations demand to be paid in dollars, you know, what is the answer to that? Well, my answer to that is, and I wanted to pick up on two points. One, something Jude said about governments have to be responsible. And another point that Jason made, which was that without the tax revenues and without the tax base, how can Africa expand the fiscal envelope? And my answer to those questions, I'll start with Jason's point. The reason why African governments have a low tax base is because they have massive unemployment, basically. The tax base comes from jobs, from the creation of jobs, because as you and I know, when you get a job, you get paid at the end of the month, but you also have to pay taxes. Of course, if you're Amazon, you can get around that. But anyway, for individuals and even for households, we all pay taxes in some form or another. We might pay as we earn, or we might have to pay when we go shopping or whatever. So if you increase unemployment, and this comes back to Jude's point about governments being responsible, I think African governments are hugely irresponsible. They tolerate levels of unemployment which would be intolerable in the West, in democracies in the West, right? And if people are angry about that, they've every right to be angry about that. And that brings me back to my point, where do we go, given that we're in this global system? We need to buy computers, we need to buy whatever, fertilizer or whatever, which costs dollars. Where do we go? Well, I've been arguing for a very long time with my African friends that we should go the way the Western governments went. Western governments didn't become rich just spontaneously. They began by building their economies on four pillars. And the pillars were these. One, they ensured that their people had food, agriculture. Secondly, they ensured that their people had a roof over their heads, construction. Thirdly, they made sure that their people were healthy. They provided health services. And in Britain, we have a national health service, which is free to everyone at the moment. And finally, they educated their people, right? If you look at a little country like Jordan has got nothing. It's a desert. I've been there. It's extraordinary. But it has a very highly educated workforce, and it has used and it's housed its workforce to an extent. They've got big problems now, but as they developed, They develop by building the capacity of their people. Now, I'm South African. The levels of unemployment in South Africa, of youth unemployment, are incredibly irresponsible. Irresponsible both in terms of a politician's responsibility to the mandate, to the election, to the people, but irresponsible in economic terms. Because if you want to balance the public books, if you want to balance the public finances, and I'm personally in favor of having public finances that are stable and balanced. I'm not one of these, I'm not an MMTer who believes you can just spend, 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 and there is no limit. I don't agree with that. I think the economy has to be in some kind of equilibrium for the sake of everyone's stability. But if you want to balance the books, the very best way to do that is to create jobs. Now, you know, it's very hard to create jobs in the techno sector if you don't have that as a base in your, but everybody has agriculture. And I know, and I've had huge rows with DFID and the British government here on this question of agriculture. I know that one of the biggest poverty reduction strategies is to expand agriculture, to ensure that people can feed themselves, that they can have enough food. Secondly, construction. You don't need to import bricks. South Africa makes its own bricks. It's completely capable of making its own bricks. And is keep and most people do make their own houses. I know, I've seen that. So that. Health, probably more difficult. But, you know, if people are fed and if they've got a roof over their heads, you're beginning on the road to establishing health. And then there's education. You know, and these are subjects that are neglected. These are areas that are neglected by African leaders. Wealth in the United States and in Britain was built on those pillars, right? And once their people were educated, fed, clothed, and so on, and kept healthy, then it's possible to expand and develop further. And so, I mean, this I know is good ivory tower stuff from me, sitting here comfortably in Britain. But, and I take completely Jude's point about how, you know, in these current circumstances, governments have no choice. African governments have no choice. But I also think that African governments don't see it as a priority to build the capacity of their people to create jobs. And I say this, I personally was very involved in the transition from apartheid to Nelson Mandela coming back. And God, it broke my heart to watch Nelson Mandela being blindsided by the IMF and the World Bank. What was needed at that point more than anything else was decent housing for African people. And pretty soon the ANC was persuaded, no, this ought to be done by the private sector. You know, you can trust the private sector to build housing for millions of people who are homeless or who have inadequate housing. So, you know, we saw how quickly African leaders just kind of walked into the framework established by the international institutions to serve the interests of the richest countries. So while I want to be humble about how easy it is for me to say all this stuff. You know, I also know that the economics profession has actually deliberately, in a sense, undermined the logic, the plain facts of economics in order to serve the interests of the great powers, really. But I come back to this simple point. If you create jobs, you create income for your economy, you create tax revenues for your government, that enables you to spend tax revenues on, for example, education or health, right? But you can't do that if you don't create jobs. It's kind of, you know, the number one thing that African governments should be doing. And I mean, I don't mind if they do it in collaboration with the private sector, we can do that. That is a fundamental responsibility of an African government. You can see I'm very heated about this.
I think that's fair enough. And in terms of jobs, at least, you know, now they are in the SDGs. There are SDGs around jobs. They weren't in the Millennium Development Goals. So it is possible even for development partners to orient around that. Whether that will be the priority coming out of COVID is another thing. There have definitely been African governments who have been saying we want to use COVID-19 finance to improve and create more jobs. We saw and protect jobs. In fact, you know, a country like Botswana had very specific policies on that quite early on as part of the COVID-19 response. Perhaps this is something that can even that coming back to the overall topic that we were talking about of the SDRs, maybe this is something that kind of job creation as well as recovery and climate change can be incorporated in that as a priority. It's just who is setting the priorities in a sense. And it comes back to that point that Jason was making also about self-determination, sovereignty, whatever we would like to call it, how much choice do countries have? So I'm gonna also ask Jason, if you can respond to another Q&A, another question that's come in from the audience, from Nick Anim, which is, can the AfCFTA, or are there in what ways can the AfCFTA disrupt the stranglehold that the lenders of last resort do have on central banks in Africa, and that which perpetuates this development of underdevelopment that we've been talking about? Can the AfCFTA do that, or is there more needed? How can we get to that viable agenda? Can SDRs even be used as a means to do that? What would be the way to do that? Jason.
Yeah, thanks for that question. And I'd like to link it up to how, you know, what Anne has said with regard to where do we go and how do we then expand the tax base, right? The ambitions of the continental free trade area has that exact ambition, right? It's to move the continent up the value chain, up the supply chain in a more integrated and harmonized way, and then by extension expanding the continent's tax base. And I think, you know, some of the elements that are within that that are contained within the continental free trade area are the beginnings or the foundations of actually genuinely moving towards the structural transformation agenda that's envisioned in Agenda 2063. Just to illustrate this with a couple of examples, if you look at what's happening in Ethiopia with the massive city that they've built there that's doing manufacturing and car assembly. If you look at what's happening in Rwanda, the same, you know, with the idea of them also doing car assembly and mobile phone assembly as well. These are the kind of ideas that, you know, if integrated within the framework of the continental free trade area, will actually move the continent from being the source of just raw materials and actually get us to the place where we're doing at least intermediate to finished goods, where there's high value, where there's, you know, in terms of the production line, you've got opportunities to create jobs. But at the core of this, and I really like the point that Anne made on agriculture. I've seen it happen here in Kenya, where we've substituted food farming or food production during the colonial times for cash crops. And now we've now even substituted cash crops and destroyed the cash crop farms now for big mega cities, right? And for the massive mega infrastructure projects to go. And the food the food security in Kenya is so precarious that we face a drought almost 2 to 3 years and famine. And so we have to rely on importing the most basic of foods that we used to have in plentiful. So things like maize or rice, wheat, things like this. So I think there's an important conversation here to really go back and relook at our development model. And whilst there is a place and a space for all different types of finances, whether it comes from the state, whether it comes from the private sector, I think there's an important role to be played here in ensuring that all forms of finance really generate a tax revenue for the state that is then kept in the economy or kept in the country and then can be reinvested in other sectors. And I think that's another component of how, you know, talking about how SDRs will be used, how the fiscal space will be created. It's also about the retention of tax revenues that are created, because we do have a significant source of fiscal leakages through illicit financial flows, tax evasion, avoidance, and so forth, leaving the continent by the so-called investors that are putting up their projects or implementing their projects on the continent. So when we're talking about all these different components and different facets of how do we ensure that the continent, through the continental free trade area or through the issuance of special drawing rights or the debt service suspension initiative, the important thing is to always ensure that the continent is able to, first of all, also keep within its borders and within its jurisdictions the resources and the revenues that it is generating, so that these can be then reinvested back into the continent and back into supporting the citizens. So it's a very long-winded answer to Nick's question about the CFTA, but I think in part, yes, there is a role there for the CFTA to play in ripping up the rule book, but it will take also a very radical set of thinking by politicians, by policymakers to really relook and rethink and reimagine what the continent's transformation is going to look like.
Yeah, thank you, Jason. And I also point to linking to AFCFTA. We also had a discussion about an African Monetary Fund, which again could play a very important role, has been ratified by a few countries, but does definitely, in order to be able to become a reality on the continent, it's the only region that doesn't have its own monetary fund and could also play a really important financial role. So it is very important that we explore these options, bring them into reality, and use them very proactively, just like AFCFTA. I'm aware that we are running out of time. Jude, would you like to
wanted
to add on questions?
I wanted to offer some comments. Yeah. I will go back again to this idea that the response to this crisis is going to be, there is no silver bullet. And to Jason's point, the SDR issuance is just one of the tools that's available. There's the hope that we can extend, at least under the general framework, extend the suspension of debt services to the end of this year and possibly to the end of next year. I think that would be very useful for countries who then free up that money to be able to invest. But I think, you know, come back to this idea of a crisis being an opportunity, that we can begin to think of what industrial policy would look like across Africa. And we can develop that industrial policy in concert with each other so that we don't develop 54 industrial policies that are at cross purpose with each other. And the AFCTA can provide a role in terms of harmonizing how we do that. And this comes back to Anne's point and Charlie's pushback in the comment section. I listened to, I have a column coming out in Africa Business, and I just in terms of how do we create jobs to be able to get Africa to that point. And I think there are three ways that we can go about this. Well, one of them, of course, is agriculture, and to Anne's point. The second one I talked about is in the mining sector, because of the amount of minerals that are mined on the continent. And then I talk about manufacturing. But I just to just make a quick point, I wanted to talk about the agriculture sector. Last in 2019, and for my column, this is what I used. In 2019, Trigger Foods, a business-to-business platform in Kenya, put out a call for proposals. They want to contract farms, but they asked that the farms be at least 50 acres, that the farms be connected to the main roads, be accessible by a main road, that the farm either had water access or that whoever owned the farm should be able to self-finance irrigation, and that the farm should be fenced. And they provided a market, for with competitive prices for whatever was produced on the farm. Well, the uptake on that call was not going to be very high. And so if one of the reasons anyone who wanted to respond to Twigger's call, the first problem they will face was the issue of land tenure. I mean, on the continent today, most people, when I was minister in Liberia, I would receive guests at the airport, and when we're driving back to town, they'll look, especially Chinese guests, they'll look on both sides of the road and be like, how are you guys hungry and poor when you have all of this land? This is insane. I cannot understand this. And when we drove up country, it was the same thing. They were like, how are you poor? The problem has been there are multiple overlapping land claims from tribal, from clan, from government. And because of that, it is almost impossible for you to be able to do farming on the scale that is required, even for smallholders, to clarify those land claims. So at any point, if we're going to make agriculture a force in the African economy, there has to be clarity on claims. There has to be some sort of order whereby if I wanted to go into agriculture, if I wanted to create a cooperative with 5 farmers in the community, we should have clear limits on who owns the land or some sort of way of being able to do that. Because without that, agriculture, I'm into agriculture. I have a rubber farm, right? And I'm trying to grow cocoa. It is a very, very risky business. And if you can remove the issue of land tenure, you actually make it easier for us, for whoever wants to do it, to take that risk. So I believe, to Anne's point, that agriculture has the capacity, especially if you develop the agricultural value chain, from cultivating to adding value, to absorb a huge portion of Africa's labor force, right? And not just because you're doing logistics, you're doing, you know, warehousing, you're doing value addition in agriculture, and it can be our gateway to some sort of manufacturing. But there are very basic things about agriculture that need to be established. So my hope is that as we clamber for debt suspension and debt service suspension, as we call for increase in SDRs, especially onward lending, and increase the amount of SDRs that's actually afforded to African countries, if there are going to be any conditions, my hope it is the Africans themselves who will offer this. And I think this is one of the last points I'll make, is when it comes to agenda setting on the international stage, Africa tends to have a muted voice. African governments are not the ones who are, you know, making the loudest noise in terms of this is what we want. And so I think industrial policy that puts agriculture at the middle, but doing the basic things that need to be in place for agriculture to be successful, will be very necessary going forward.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jude. Now, we have literally 4 minutes left for this discussion, and I still want to ask our audience poll at the end of what we will do, but I'm going to ask all of you to give us your final words and framed around one particular question, which is, if you were, and this is our wrap-up question, if you were to advise African leaders now what to do with respect to reimagining the use of special drawing rights, given how wide our discussion has been, it really will be imagining quite broad, how would you suggest they proceed? And so just 1 minute each, if possible. What's your advice to African leaders? How do they get their voice heard on this? What should they be saying? Jason, you first.
Oh, thanks. I thought you were going to go with Anne first. I'll go first very quickly.
Mixing it up.
But the first thing is, first of all, is not to see the SDR as a silver bullet. That's the first thing. And this is not going to solve the medium to long-term fiscal challenges that the government's going to face. The second point is investments now need to be in 3 areas. There's the social sector, which is education, health, water and sanitation, in protecting the population. And the third is investments need to be transformative. There needs to be a plan where the investments that are being made today build the governments or build the economies out of this in a stronger way. So it's a sort of move away from the hard physical infrastructure that has dominated over the last decade and sort of build the more softer social infrastructure that will maintain and sort of, in a way, also equalize out society. And I think, you know, things like and getting sectors to speak to each other. I think Jireh has mentioned a very good point on agriculture, but then you've got to have an education system that speaks to the kind of economy that you want. We all can't be in the technology sector, right? Some of us need to do the hard graft and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Excellent. Thank you, Jason. Great advice. Anne,
your thoughts? So my advice to an African leader would be jobs, jobs, jobs. Whoops. Have you... Am I unmuted?
That's fine. You're here. Yep, you're perfect. Jobs, jobs,
so jobs, jobs, jobs. And I hear what Jason is saying, or was it Jude, sorry, was saying about agriculture and about land claims and so on. These are all complicated. Can I say one of the most important areas of work is the work that women do, and that's caring work, right? And you don't need agricultural land or lawyers or contracts or whatever to do an awful lot of caring work. But caring work is also undervalued. It's not regarded as important. But caring for children, caring for the elderly, caring for the sick, these are jobs that can be done without building fancy infrastructure necessarily, right? I would like African leaders to be more imaginative about what kind of jobs they can create within the constraints that they have. But first of all, they've got to create jobs that'll give them political stability, it'll give their public finances economic stability, and it'll give them a platform on which to build to challenge the international system.
Okay. All right, jobs as the answer to the grey rhino. Jude, you have the last word.
Industrial policy. Every single country that has come through, I know that most African countries face resistance at the IFIs when they talk of industrial policy, because the previous iteration of industrial policy failed because governments attempted to pick winners. And so, you know, there's not a lot of support. But the good thing is the IFIs are not the only actors now. You have China. You know, this thing where there's this war and stuff. Look, China provides, and this is something I feel like African governments, especially on the fact of developing their domestic agricultural sector, they haven't really exploited. If the World Bank doesn't agree with your development policy, if the IMF thinks your industrial policy, it's not the right thing to do, well, you've for the last 20 years, we've had China that we can go to. In some instances, the Chinese financing was almost as much as we were getting from development banks. So I think coming out of this, one of the things that African governments have to stress and do it as best as they possibly can is some sort of industrial policy that centers agriculture in their economies.
Okay, so that's how they should use SDRs. Question will be, do governments have the space to do that? We will have to see. And I guess part of the next steps from this conference, from this webinar, will be kind of working on ensuring that they do have that self-determination in a sense, to be able to put forward to actually implement these sorts of recommendations coming out of here. Well, I want to thank you all. Let's have our audience question. I think the answer to this poll will be very interesting. Just before we close, let's put the poll out there. DR team, are you ready? Okay, in light of our discussion today, should SDRs be reallocated directly to African countries or directed to the IMF or World Bank to disburse to African countries? So it's a fairly narrow question, but I think nevertheless, it will be pretty interesting to see what they say. Answer number one is they should be reallocated directly to African countries. Number two, the IMF or bank should disburse them. And three, neither. SDR reallocation would not be helpful. So we'll just wait for a few more seconds to see the results. And in the meantime, I want to say thank you so much to our panelists for a really fantastic discussion and dialogue on this issue. I think we all learned so much from all of you. Really fantastic. All right, let's see what the audience said. What are the results? Aha, okay. We have 58% of the audience saying SDR should be reallocated directly to African countries. And I'm guessing to deal with and be able to implement some of the ideas that our panelists have discussed today. We have 25% saying the IMF or banks should disperse them, and then 17%, an interesting 17% saying SDR reallocation would not be helpful at all. So thank you. Thank you again, panelists. Thank you, audience, for sharing your views with us, sharing your questions as well for our panelists. Really fantastic. And thank you, everybody who has tuned in to this webinar series. Thank you all for joining this journey with us. Looking forward to, let's see if we launch another one. But for now, thank you to DR team as well and our translators for all their work, hard work on this webinar series. It's been great. And we look forward to working with all of you again and continuing to work with you all again very soon. Take care, everyone.
Cheers.
Great. Thanks. Bye. Stay well.
Thank you. Bye.